Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. With Jeff Fawcett, PhD, we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Blood iron, like so many things, has a delicate balance. Too much or too little can be the basis for chronic illness. I still remember TV ads when I was a child warning of the dangers of iron-poor blood. There were gray, tired-looking women were perked up by taking Geritol. Many food products and vitamins are iron-enriched, and now we're seeing a connection between too much iron and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, cancers, even dementia, psychiatric disorders, and autism. The numbers of young adults with these conditions and iron overload is rising. When iron levels get too high, it's the liver that needs to sequester iron to protect our tissues. So alcohol consumption can damage the liver and lead to iron overload. Some are genetically predisposed to hang on to iron. So if the diet's too high in iron and iron is consumed in processed foods or supplements, the levels get too high. But wait, when iron gets too low, anemia is also dangerous. There are many things to consider. First, checking iron levels correctly and understanding the results, knowing which foods and supplements to consume in what balance, and if necessary, what things can be done to resolve iron overload or anemia. Join us today as we unpack the often missed diagnosis of iron overload. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Why are people still smoking? Don't they know it's bad for their health? I hadn't thought about those questions for several years when the CDC recently published some statistics in its Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. In the report, the CDC documents the extent of smoking in the United States. It was one of those, you've got to be kidding, moments. Almost 20% of the people in the United States smoke, one out of every five. That's a slight decline from 2005. More shocking to me is the distribution of smokers by age. The highest percentage of smoking is going on among young adults, aged 18 to 24, almost 24%, one out of four. The next age group, 25 to 34, smokes almost as much. The next two age groups, 35 to 44 and 45 to 64, were a little lower, but not by much, 21 and 20%, respectively. Past 65, however, the percentage of smokers drops like a rock to 10%, half the national average. This is an utter failure on the part of public health institutions. I smoked for over 10 years. I quit. I was so good at it that I quit several times. It's not so easy. So I don't tend to feel the righteous indignation exhibited by some towards smokers of, I quit, what's wrong with you? Tobacco companies, that's another story. But I want to lay aside the issue of quitting smoking and focus instead on what interests the tobacco companies, getting customers. That's what I find so troubling about these statistics. The statistician in me says that if public health institutions are doing their job, the number of new smokers, the adults younger than 35, should be smaller, not larger, than older smokers. Why? Because the public health apparatus should have had plenty of time to prevent young people from starting to smoke. But it hasn't, so they failed. Yes, it's true that the number of smokers has declined since it became the official policy of the United States Surgeon General and the government generally that cigarette smoking can be hazardous to your health. But again, I ask, why are people still starting to smoke at all? The simple answer is that they made a deliberate decision to fire up a cigarette for the first time. So why would a kid do that? Or an adult, for that matter? I've been reading the work of a social psychologist on a process called story editing. What this means is that we all have a story or narrative in terms of which we place our actions. To light the first cigarette and keep going, someone has, for example, cool people smoke in her story that makes sense from her perspective and in the context in which she acts out the story she has running in her head. That story can be edited, changed to read, for example, I don't have to smoke to be cool. The important point isn't the specific example of whether smoking is cool. The important point is that story editing is something you do for yourself, possibly with help, something we can do for each other. But of course, there's more. The context in which we act out the story that's running in our head includes a political economy in which there are, for example, anti-smoking public service announcements countering marketing campaigns by tobacco companies. You will not be surprised to know that tobacco companies outspend anti-smoking public health programs by a factor of 25. That is, for every dollar spent on an anti-smoking campaign, $25 is spent by the tobacco industry to encourage someone to take that first hit and keep on going. I could go on, but I think you get the idea. Starting and continuing to smoke has less to do with health and addiction than it has to do with our social being, the school of fish in which we cavort, and who controls the pond in which we fishies swim. Some other statistics from the CDC are revealing. White people have the highest percentage of smokers, 20% more than African Americans, 50% more than Hispanics. Despite, I might add, heavy expenditures by the tobacco industry in communities of color. However, people who are poor are more likely to smoke by 50%. People with less than a high school education are three times more likely to smoke than someone with a college degree. Getting some college improves that a little to 2.5 instead of 3 times. In fact, having a college degree marks a sharp cutoff. Someone with a college degree is dramatically less likely to be a smoker. Aha, you might think, all we need to do is get everybody through college in order to kick the habit. A nice thought, but hopelessly muddled. Is it the education that prevents the smoking? Or is it socioeconomic advantages that lead to both the degree and rejection of smoking? Or is it the personal narrative that gets someone through college and stops them from lighting up for the first time? And isn't socioeconomic context what makes sense of the narrative in the first place? I'm telling you, it will give you a headache. In my opinion, the simple answer is that there's no simple answer. Why do people still light up that first cigarette, or take that first drink, or first try that wireless PDA that they now can't live without? Because they are in a story where doing those things makes sense in their socioeconomic context. That context is controlled by political economic forces that are unprincipled and devious and interested not one bit in anyone's story. The hope lies in the capacity of each person to edit their story, help others in editing their story, and edit the context so that stories without smoking make sense. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
And as you guys all know by now, Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And if my guests can be patient for one more second, I have an editorial. With the passing of Andy Rooney, this came into my mind. It's very short. I'll be brief. And since Andy isn't here to do this anymore, I will. Ever notice that everyone is using wireless? Ever wonder why? A wireless internet router, the kind used for your high-speed internet, radiates between 300 and 350 feet in a circle around it. Enough for the migrating birds to use Google Maps as they fly over. Seriously, does everybody need one of these? Couldn't neighbors share the signal and save themselves some money? After all, everything wireless can be hacked into, so what's the point of securing your signal? Isn't that a little miserly? And what about the increasing number of people who are getting headaches, ringing in their ears, high blood pressure, and insomnia from all this wireless? That can't be good. And if a neighbor to one of those wireless internet routers, you can't get away from it. What's the point of that? At least with smoking, you could forbid it in your house. Now you get wireless whether you want it or not. So maybe next time you think, hey, I could be sitting outside working on my laptop, remember your neighbors and the migrating birds that are getting confused by these signals because they interfere with the magnetic fields of the earth, and get a wired connection. After all, it's hard to hack into one of those, and you might even get a good night's sleep. Everyone knows who I am. So let's get to our topic for today, which is iron overload, and our guest, who is waiting patiently on the line, Dr. Richard Cunyon, MD. He's formulator of all the Olaloa products. is a nutrition-oriented physician and orthomolecular specialist with over 30, actually it's more than 30 years of experience in the nutrition medicine field. He pioneered the use of vitamins and minerals in today's medical practice. He is co-founder of the Orthomolecular Medical Society with Dr. Linus Pauling. That was back in 76. It's still going. He's published many books. Some of them are Mega Nutrition and Mega Nutrition for Women, and numerous published articles that have been seen in various journals. In 1994, he founded the Society for Orthomolecular Health Medicine, OHM, in San Francisco. Their website is ohm.org, ohmsf.org. And the mission of this organization is to put nutrition first in the practice of medicine. And through this organization, Dr. Kunyon brings together medical doctors and other health practitioners to discuss current nutritional approaches to treating disease states. And, of course, in Dr. Kunyon's own medical practice, he practices a strategy of nutrition, detoxification, and adaptive support that integrates all aspects of modern preventive health care. So again, it's ohmsociety.com, or you can go to org. No, org? I think it's .com. Richard, is it .org or .com? You don't know, do you?
It's .com, as a matter
of fact. It's
.com. You couldn't get the org.
Yeah, and then the drinkyourvitamins.com also has information about Dr. Kunyon and some articles. So here we are. Welcome.
Well, thank you. That extra couple of minutes allowed me to get more ideas.
Look out.
Well, I'm getting a lot of ideas. You know,
yes.
You do these getting togethers, of meeting of our minds and meeting our
yes.
minds with the audience out
yes.
there, and we find that responsibility makes us think a little harder.
We do. So to that end, what's curious and interesting about iron in the blood, which and then there's all kinds of issues about there's heme iron and then there's the metal iron and there's the difference there, but too much or too little, and it causes all kinds of problems like fatigue all the way to heart disease. So this is
well,
tricky.
Well, it goes. There's a lot more personal stuff than that. Certainly, the iron overload, and I don't want to interrupt you too much, but the iron overload should include, as early, because you're mentioning heart, obvious symptoms. In addition to that, arthritis is often at least aggravated and in many cases caused by the iron overload. It's the first sign in the middle-aged onset arthritis. And also, in today's world, it's not impolite to talk about ED. For men, the
erectile dysfunction. See, you can't even say it. Notice
that's
it's
right.
Not hard to say.
I'm obviously neurotic.
No, it's just hard to say.
But in this case, instead of blaming my mother, I can blame iron.
Iron, yes.
So
yeah. Well, you know, the other thing I wondered about, too, is, the iron, because it's so oxidative, it damages, it sequesters and damages organs. There are other things I wondered about. Is hair loss related? I noticed that in postmenopausal women, they often tell me they're losing their hair, both on their body and on their head.
Well, that, as a matter of fact, is one of the indicators, and I think it's secondary through the pituitary, that there's pituitary damage. Gradual buildup deposits of iron in the pituitary gland have a major impact on disrupting and imbalancing hormonal production.
Ah, that was my next question.
Yeah.
And so I would think the thyroid is interfered with, and then the other hormones as well?
Well, it's really best viewed in order to especially make it easier for our audience to understand, because let me give you two thoughts. The first thought is that iron is a nutrient, so you got to have it. It's an essential requirement for health and well-being and survival.
And your detox pathways don't work without it, too.
Of all the nutrients, this one is the most serious when it's an overdose. And so people that can't get rid of it easily are at greater risk, which is to say men, because men, unfortunately, don't menstruate. You like that one. But the only place that men can lose the iron is through nosebleeds and hemorrhoids. Or, how do you like that one? Or taking aspirin and bleeding sort of gradually.
Abdominal and inner,
in the intestinal.
The duodenum.
But that's rather dangerous, as we all know, because you can, for some people, bleed out and without even knowing it. I'm not recommending that. Mm-hmm. But what I am recommending is just to recognize that iron, because it's a nutrient, most of us, including doctors, I think, tend to take it lightly. about the only real hazard has been iron pills given to women who lose too much blood and become anemic for one reason or another, but usually just too heavy menstruation, the menorrhagia, it's called. And the iron bottle, iron pills are sugar-coated, and they're left at home somewhere where a baby or a child can reach them, and the sweet deceives the child into thinking it's good to eat, and the child will eat the whole bottle as candy, and it's fatal. So that's the leading cause of nutrition-related death. It's a tragic, tragic thing, but it's...
Well, it's just about the only thing that's related.
Mentioning first.
It's about the only thing that's related to nutritional supplement death.
Well, you're actually right, mm-hmm. although that some might say that vitamin A, because of its impact, potential impact on overdose in pregnancy, causing birth defects or
but we're talking about iron today,
sure.
So I don't want to get people worried about
right, but
something.
Just to say, of all the nutrition, just the concept is important.
Yes.
That nutrition is absolutely notoriously safe.
Yes.
And iron is the singular toxic nutrient at doses that are attainable through diet over a period of time. For example, there was a study in Italy where they did a study on people over age 70 in a convalescent or a retirement community. If they drank espresso up to 2 cups, I think it was, or even 3 cups a week, their death rate, mortality, you know, age-related mortality, dropped 60%. It was huge.
Wow, because it chelates the iron?
That's right.
Wow. And tea does, too.
Tea does also.
Yeah.
On the other hand, those who ate meat had a tenfold increase in mortality. In other words, older folks, people over 70, may find that what we're talking about is singularly important, because even if they haven't got the full-blown iron overload syndrome, which is called hemochromatosis, if they don't have hemochromatosis, they may still be accumulating iron over a lifetime, mm-hmm. which gets gradually built up in the system to a unhealthy level. And before you die, of course, you may not feel so good for a long while.
Mm-hmm.
And starting, as we were saying, with erective failure, with the sexual loss of libido, with depression, sometimes very serious depression, with aches and pains, with arthritis, with, in fact, deformed joints. It aggravates almost every other illness of the aging human being. That is, you may have something else that wouldn't be such a big deal, but when you peroxidize the tissues around a short blood supply, an organ that isn't well supplied with blood, perhaps the brain or the heart, instead of just having a little ache or a pain, you may go to a full-blown clot and end up going into serious damage or even death. So the iron story is a big story, and I must say in recent years I've become increasingly aware of it and aware of how common it is and how seldom it is diagnosed. That's why we're really talking today, because that means if we wake a few people up, they ought to be very grateful to you, Lena, for thinking of it.
And you as well.
Well, so I stumbled into it because it turns out, as you get older, you start reviewing your medicine. I've got time to go back over and do things for the second, third, and 20th time. And you finally, one day, you see the light. You get it, especially when that certain patient walks into your office, as happened to me a few years back. If you want the story,
I want to just ask you a couple of very small questions before we do. I mentioned that iron sequesters in the tissues and organs, and I'd like to go over some of the things that protect and some of the things that don't. But also, iron has an effect on the mitochondria, which means that it's either too low or too high, it's going to affect your energy.
Well, absolutely. So it would certainly then be in people with chronic fatigue,
a serious consideration.
Right. Remember, the full-blown iron, genetic iron overload syndrome, the ones where you're almost certain to accumulate iron in the course of a lifetime to a symptomatic level, that is about 1 in every 200 people. It's not rare.
Right.
But of the ones that show up and get diagnosed, they make up almost 90%. That means those who just have what is called a heterozygous genetic, where they're carrying a iron overload gene, where they absorb too much iron from just one parent instead of two. The full-blown has got the homozygous with a gene from each parent. So these that have the lesser mutation may still have a lot of symptoms. In fact, the first case that walked into my office where I really woke up and said, gee, Dick, you've been missing a lot of these over the years, was a tragedy. I mean, here was a young lad who just was so depressed that he was starting to talk suicide all the time at 24 years of age. It just didn't make any sense because he was not psychotic, was not bipolar. He was just plain miserable. He had plenty of psychological support from his psychiatrist, and he came through, did a nutritional survey, including iron, and it turned out that he was up at about 50%, right at the borderline for a formal diagnosis of iron overload at such a young age.
Mm.
And the 50% saturation of the iron protective protein called transferrin. Well, he didn't have a high ferritin, which is the liver protein for iron. He only had the high saturation of transferrin, which is the blood protein. So you see already the conundrum is trying to figure out what compartment of the body are we talking about? How do you make the diagnosis? And if it were to really get real, how do you find the diagnosis of what's in the blood cell or in the other cells of the body? More or less an iron biopsy. Well, I didn't have access to that, but I got very suspicious with the 50% saturation that could be a factor in his depression. But I thought, well, nah, he's too young, he hasn't got the overload yet, and it's high, we have to warn him, he has to be careful. And of course, darn if this young man didn't in fact end his life.
Mm.
Before I only saw him twice, so I didn't have a chance to really work this out with him. And he was from Los Angeles, so he was down in Southern California. It was hard for him to get up to make more contact, or maybe we would have had better luck. But it shook me up. I mean, I have had a long career, much more than 30 years, as you know, almost over 50 now.
Yes.
And I don't lose many patients. In fact, I can remember by name everyone that's ever had that mishap or other, mm-hmm. sometimes other means of exiting this mortal coil. So I took this hard, and as one of the major landmarks in my own awareness of what's important in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important because it is treatable, fixable. Doesn't
mm-hmm.
have to happen. You can be helped by the doctor, and once you learn what you're doing, those of us out there who are so afflicted have the power to stay healthy better, no matter what else you do. If you've got cholesterol problems, and you might have concern about your blood vessels, if you've got a high iron, too, it's going to be worse,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. In other words, iron is the wild card in the deck,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of the wild cards that you can control very very well, and the earlier you get wise to it, the easier it is to control, because it's not easy to get it out. You can
right. Well, let's get to that in just a moment. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. This is Lena Berman. I'm interviewing Richard Cunyon, MD, again, and we're talking about iron overload. One of the things two things that came up in that story. One is that and I've seen this in my practice as well. The people who you try everything you can think of to help with depression, and nothing works. And psychiatric meds don't work. And you know, now I'm remembering a case like that myself, so I'm going to have to go through my files and find him and call him.
Already, this little get-together has been worth it.
Sure.
So, start recalling these things.
So, one of the things that you're saying, to unpack some of the things that you said, one of the things you're saying is that the way that doctors test for iron is often misread, and they often don't test enough things. So they'll do a hemoglobin and a hemocrit, and they'll do a red cell, you know, red blood cells. But you're also testing iron saturation, and we shared a case recently where this came up, and we were talking about it, of a postmenopausal woman whose iron saturation was within the range of what the lab considers normal.
Right, so that the lab.
So she was at 42%, and they're saying, yeah, the lab value said it was all right, up to 55. But her serum ferritin, which is where the liver is collecting, this is one of the protective. This is one of the ways that the body tries to protect you. Her serum ferritin was 3 times above normal, which meant that her liver was working and it was holding on to it. And her ceruloplasma, which is related to, in this case, her using low doses of replacement hormone. So she had enough estrogen on board to create ceruloplasm, plasma.
Right, the estrogen induces your body to make more of it.
Which is another protective
strategy that the body has. So I looked at the results and I said, wow, this is, you know, her hemoglobin's higher, hematocrit, her red cells, but her iron saturation looks all right. And you said, no, the iron saturation should be below 35%. And that's one of the problems, I think.
Well, I've lowered my threshold of tolerance down to 35. I think 50 is too high and it's throwing people off. So they're discounting people who are seriously in overload and at risk of having major symptoms and major damage in their future years. Once you've got the patient there, if as a doctor you don't catch these things, the probability is no one else will either, because they look at the old records and they see it. The laboratory says it should be 50% and it's 40%. Maybe it went up from 35, it went up to 40 by the time you get to your next. If you wait for it to get to 50, already the liver is getting congested and full of iron, and then think about what else, because it's highly individual. It might turn out to be your kidneys. It might turn out to be the muscle of the heart. It might turn out to be the pituitary gland. It might turn out to be somewhere in the brain, in the realm of Parkinsonism, because there's a part of the brain that concentrates iron, substantia nigra. So all these things are important. And then, hey, it may be your total body iron in the tissues everywhere, the lining of the gut, the skin. You may have skin disorders. You may have chronic bowel disease, because the iron is amplifying the inflammatory component that puts everything else out of kilter. So it's really not a simple puzzle. It's a very artful thing to figure it out.
Let me just bring up another thing, too, since I want to, at some point here, I want us to just actually list the tests that should be run, because they're very easy to get hold of. You don't even, you know, you can even go to Life Extension website and order some of these tests. But because the liver, you know, we just talked about the estrogen being protective because it creates ceruloplasma, and that sequesters the iron as well. We also mentioned that the ferritin gets really high because the liver is trying to protect it. Now, another case where doctors would miss that there's a problem is in a case of anemia, you're seeing low red blood cells.
Well, the anemia,
and that's dangerous.
Right.
That's very dangerous. Explain why.
Red blood cells themselves protect against iron poisoning. Right. If you're making a lot of new blood, the iron is being taken up by the new red blood cells right out of the bone marrow and then safely stored there, so that if you've got someone who is well able to make new blood, they are protected to the extent that the blood can hold it. What happens, though, especially in vigorous and healthy men, is that their red blood cells become so numerous that you almost develop a polycythemia, a high hematocrit, which is to say the volume of the red blood cells is so great it's displacing the fluid part, and your blood gets kind of thick, and then you start running into the stuffed subway car kind of a thing, and the cells can't get through to deliver the oxygen load, and so that's a different kind of symptomology.
Well, but what I wanted to get across here is that in anemia, since the red blood cells are low, and they're not sequestering the iron. Without them, the iron is going to go to the liver, and that's going to damage the liver. So, you know, a lot of doctors, it's like what they do with blood pressure. You know, you have this really low blood pressure. It might indicate that you're actually in a collapse situation, and they go, oh, that's really good that your blood pressure is low. So you don't want to see a low red blood cell count or a low iron count.
Well, that's right, and we haven't even mentioned the fact beyond the blood that when that happens, the liver becomes susceptible to two things. One is just direct inflammatory injury called cirrhosis, or fatty liver, and leading to a fibrotic liver called cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. Two stages there. And the second is the susceptibility of the liver to viral hepatitis goes way up, particularly hepatitis C cases that otherwise would be non-symptomatic become not only symptomatic, they lead to a higher frequency of liver cancer.
Well, and in fact, you know, some reading I did online, it indicated to me that there's a relationship between the iron status and the capacity to fight microbes and infections and things
exactly
like that.
Exactly right. In fact, that's a confounding variable, because Mother Nature recognizes that. Evolution learned that a million to 100 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have hormones in the blood called acute phase proteins that lower the circulating iron.
Right.
And in that case, if you test somebody when they're in that acutely inflamed or even chronically inflamed state, which is common in patients going to the doctor, the iron will be so low that the transferrin in your blood will not be saturated.
Mm.
And so you missed the diagnosis because you tested at the wrong time.
I got to take a quick break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm talking today with Dr. Richard Cunyon about iron overload, and anemia is being mentioned as well. We're just going to listen to about 30 seconds worth of music. Please stay on the line. We'll be right back with this interview. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a show today with Richard Cunyon, MD, about iron overload. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guest, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, our book, and there's just tons of stuff at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can contact us if you wish by emailing us at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Richard's website for the Orthomolecular Health Medicine Society is ohmsociety.com. Go to the SF portion. And you can also find information and studies by Richard at drinkyourvitamins.com. Just look for about Dr. Cunyon. So we're talking about iron overload and, you know, this very delicate balance and the protection that's built in, you know, to the systems, and about the difficulty in testing. So why don't we just maybe actually tell people which tests are essential to order?
Well, let's put it, as you have already stated, the basic is, first of all, a serum iron, just an ordinary part of the complete SMA chem panel, chem as in chemistry.
So a CBC.
So if you did just that, you at least get a hint. The problem is if it doesn't show there, for example, if you catch it at the wrong time and the iron has been lowered by those acute phase proteins, you'll miss it. At the same time that that's done, there is a companion test called the transferrin and transferrin saturation. Sometimes these are called IBC or iron binding capacity, and the unsaturated iron binding capacity. So it gets confusing for the introductory. If you never heard it before, you know, you probably won't remember all this, but that's why I like to boil it down to bottom line. It's called transferrin. Ferrin is a Latinized version of iron. So transferrin and the saturation of transferrin is really the key number that is most likely to give an answer. Sometimes if it's suspected, because you have to really look at the total picture to get an intelligent, reliable read on it, and that really, I think, does take an experienced doctor who's, especially one who's worked with nutritional factors and is accustomed to the fact that nutrition doesn't stay the same minute to minute, let alone day to day, in some of these dynamic numbers. So you really have to look at it with the background also of the ferritin and the ceruloplasmin. And there is probably one other, once you've got an index of suspicion, you can do an injection of a iron detoxifier called deferoxamine.
Well,
that test brings out the iron into the urine.
Oh, that's a test to see whether you're high iron.
Yeah, so it does things at once. It gives you also a chance you maybe feel better.
Uh-huh.
So that it's a double. So I kind of like that. I'm going to be doing that as a routine.
As a test.
Because in my practice, I'm now looking back over the mistakes I've made over the years by not being informed properly in this area. And I can see I am missing about, at least 30% of my practice has been underdiagnosed here. Yeah. I'm picking it up with about as little success as most of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, either the Orthodox or the orthomolecular.
Yep.
Everyone's been missing this.
So, yeah, I hear that. In my practice, I think it would make sense. I mean, I'm obviously telling people now to look at, you know, the hemocrit and the white cells and the hemoglobin and the serum ferritin. And I'm also saying, please do an iron saturation, do an, an iron saturation percentage. But, again, you know, is the iron saturation test also going to be affected poorly by, you know, if someone's fighting a cold or something?
Yes.
Ah.
If you have a high white blood cell count,
yes,
it's very likely that your iron will actually be an active lowered iron. It won't be the cruising speed iron of your everyday. It'll
look lower.
Your acute phase proteins have lowered it, mm-hmm, and taken it out of circulation to prevent the infection from being worse.
So that's really important.
For example, some of these hospital infections are in people who have these high irons, and they get a staphylococcus, and it runs wild. See, this iron thing is not a little. This is a
No, it's huge. All right. Now, we've mentioned the fact that the people that are at risk, obviously, are men and postmenopausal women. And now we're seeing, as you pointed out, your first case story that you shared, young adults. So it's not just a genetic hemochromatosis. I have to think that there are other factors besides alcohol consumption that can predispose someone to having high iron. I mean, it does sound like you'll have, like you said, a genetic variant. But what about other metal toxicities? Are they comorbid, like having a high mercury? Would that be comorbid with iron?
I haven't seen much in the literature about that, but I have no doubt that that is so. It's because metal toxicity in general is a major cause of depression.
Yes.
And now you've got metal overload that block, most of the metals block the folic acid and B12 part of the action, which creates the neurotransmitters that regulate mood. And they also control the production of carnitine and coenzyme Q. I mean, that was what Ololo was all about, was to give enough backup production of these factors through the so-called methyl carbon, the methylation pathway, it would clear up many of these everyday fatigue states and depressions and the aches and pains of not being very healthy. Mm-hmm. But you throw iron into it also, and it's not a little thing. In fact, one of the things that happens with iron is an antagonist to the function of zinc.
I just knew it.
And believe it or not, it screws up your prostate gland and sets you up for prostate cancer.
I did see that in the literature.
Men are in big trouble if they don't treat it early. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
And it's totally treatable. In fact, one of the tests that I do for my practice is a test of the defensive cells of the body, the lymphocytes, and we identify 33 of the nutrition factors that are essential to health. And that includes zinc. It doesn't include iron. The iron test is separate, but it does include zinc. And what I see when I have people who are low zinc, the next thing I do is look for iron, because the iron is very often has induced the low zinc because iron is intracellular.
Well, and here you go again with women, because the ceruloplasma also interferes. You tend to be a high copper when that's happening, and then the copper contests the zinc too.
Well,
so in women
you
see it as well.
Are.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really a marvelously readable conundrum. That is, it's nice to have a puzzle you can solve. And
well,
this is a puzzle that is not being solved very well. Probably 90-something percent of the cases are missed. This is, in other words, if you took a look at that realistically, of the millions of doctor visits going on in the world today, 90% of them are missing the diagnosis of iron overload.
Yes, but if I might say, you know, Jeffrey and I really work in a way that stresses doing the simplest things first. So I know that there are chelators like deferoxamine that you can use, but indeed, if the person isn't spectacularly You know, if the overload isn't so spectacular that you have to do something immediately to protect the liver from cirrhosis, in the case of, say, this case that we're sharing, where the woman's at 42%, the first thing you do is, you know, you change the diet, and then there are changes that you make to the nutrients that you're taking, the way you take your nutrients, like taking vitamin C away from food, because when you take vitamin C with food, you absorb more iron from the food.
Well, that perhaps is one of the more strategic things to do, because the vitamin C... I wouldn't call it craze, but at least certainly it's a fad in the sense that it is being used as a general rather than a specific nutrition advice, mm-hmm. that vitamin C should go up into the mega dose range. I've always been quite cautious about it. I myself am a heterozygote for iron, and I've had to struggle myself alone figuring out the fact that the symptoms that I've had to deal with in my own life, in large measure, now that I look back on it, have been related to this one factor that has been downplayed everywhere else, so it even threw me off as a doctor trying to save my own skin.
Yeah, but you're not taking vitamin C. You're taking it away from food.
Well, I never took it at high doses because I found it didn't agree with me. I've listened to my body.
Well, high doses...
I think the so-called vitamin C
flush.
Diarrhea...
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Clearly it's... a lower threshold. Mm-hmm. People like me at 5 and 6 grams found that was my limit, whereas Linus Pauling was 20 grams.
Oh yeah, but I'm talking about people taking... People don't even take 2 grains. So I'm thinking, you know, if somebody takes 2 or 3 grams a day and they just take it away from food, but obviously
that also could be a good test for iron.
Which
just take some vitamin C and see what level you get.
Oh, before you get
diarrhea.
Yeah,
and if you're getting it at 1 gram or 2 grams a day,
you know you're in trouble.
You know you've probably got iron or some other metal that's lining your gut and is acting as a free radical, but it's activated by the vitamin C. So it's not a bad idea to put that in mind. I actually am glad we're having this talk. I'm about to change my strategy. This is the cheapest way to do it.
Well, I always look for the cheapest way. Let me just say a couple of other things. One is that anybody listening to the show who's a regular listener to the show will know that I'm now up against my constant recommendation that people not be afraid of red meat. I still say that red meat is appropriate for some people, but it's clear that if somebody has these symptoms, if you know, postmenopausal women, men as people age, it may be important to look at switching to, you heard it here first, some meals where you're maybe eating beans, but you do want to prepare the beans carefully. So on the other hand, I'm not saying not to eat animal protein. I'm saying, because in fact, very strict vegetarians become anemic, which is another, can also, we said earlier, will cause the iron to end up in the liver and damage the liver because the red cells are too low. So you have to be very careful that you get what you need, and people are different. And of course, some people do perfectly well on a vegetarian diet with eggs and dairy if they're able to do it.
What you're describing is really the challenge for orthomolecular doctors like me,
yeah,
who try to help people to learn what their limits are, what their needs are, maybe I put that backwards, what their needs are first and what their limits are second,
mm-hmm.
so that they could take some responsibility for their own well-being.
Yes. Yeah, and then just to go on from there, there are foods, obviously, that are lower in heme iron, like fish, although I'm myself, I won't touch fish from the ocean anymore because of Fukushima, so I'm buying fish that's only raised in fresh water, but there's also white meat chicken and white meat turkey, and then eggs, oddly enough, even though they have iron, don't have heme iron, so they're not as provocative to eat. And then there's also adding in some of the foods that have been given a bad rap because they have phytic acid in them, and it may turn out that the phytic acid is in nature's way of protecting us from high iron. So the phytic acid in beans and nuts and vegetable stuff, you know, may in fact be protective. And there are products that you can buy. There's a product called IP6 made by several companies. And
which is a soybean-derived product.
Is that where it's derived from? Oh, dear, that's a bad...
I've seen it. But the soybeans,
that's
also
too bad.
Lower zinc, interestingly enough. I've seen that happen in pregnant women.
Well, isn't it... Well, now, wait a minute. Let's go over this IP6 for a second before we go too far.
Inositol-hexaphosphate,
yes.
Phytate, is present in lots of vegetables. So it's not
It doesn't... I've been communicating with one of the companies trying to get an answer on this because I don't want to give it to people who are horribly allergic allergic to soy and things like that. But my sense is that this is processed enough and denatured enough so that it's not like taking soy.
I think you're right.
Now, that's an interesting product, and some of the testimonials on the site for it talk about people with hemochromatosis actually being able to do this, use this and not have to do, and here we go to the obvious, the cheapest treatment for iron overload, which is to give blood.
Right.
And so they've been able, so I'm saying there's, you know, there's the food and you change the food. There's taking extra vitamin E for your liver and taking your antioxidants for your liver, and the zinc gets low, and the, taking all your supplements and protecting your body from all of this oxidizing, this iron oxidizing. But then you can also go and immediately give blood. And one of the magical things about doing the blood donation, along with the fact that you're helping by doing this, is that you're also getting rid of, as you said, a whole bunch of other things that are toxins in your body. You're suddenly just emptying out a bunch of stuff.
Absolutely right. And in fact, that's where I was myself last night.
Mm-hmm. How are you feeling?
Fine. But just to show you, it's on my schedule of regular things mm-hmm. to do. There is a practical element in one's self-care program. Not for everybody.
Not for everybody.
If you're
anemic, you're in trouble.
Lots of people with kidney problems, you know, don't make blood very easily because the hormone erythropoietin is a kidney hormone. So you've got to know what you're doing to do these things. And that's why getting in touch with the orthomolecular community of doctors who are getting experience like this is, at this point, I think the best way to do it. I do have a prejudice as president of the Orthomolecular Society, but nevertheless, mm-hmm. it's also something we believe in sincerely.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Richard Cunyon, MD, and we're talking about iron overload and a bit about anemia as well. I might also mention before we disappear away from supplements to mention that eating calcium containing, eating dairy with animal protein will blunt the effect of the, will block the absorption of iron. So if you're anemic, you don't want to take calcium or eat a lot of dairy with your things. You know, if you, in other words, if you're anemic and you need to increase the iron, then that's going to be a thing. But let's go back to the blood donation because it's an interesting, I'm really interested in the fact that you said that, you know, particularly for like this one case that we were sharing, the woman is electrosensitive and chemically sensitive. And it's interesting that you were saying that the iron overload, because iron is a metal, it's a conductive metal, it's probably causing people to be more electrosensitive. And I've noticed that a lot of postmenopausal women are electrosensitive. And a lot of men,
well,
too.
Well, that's a very interesting point. I looked up a couple of things in my, with my colleague, Dr. Google.
Yes.
I found one very interesting research article out of Pakistan, of all things, where they're trying to make coal burn better, and they were using microwave.
Oh, yeah.
And they found a microwave-iron interaction was found to generate higher heat and higher temperature, which was used for a rapid burning of coal. Rapid. This converted coal into a liquid, gaseous fuel products. What I'm getting at is the nature of atoms and elements changes mm-hmm. with the interaction between microwave and the iron in these earth products. So it was much more effective using the microwave than it was with conventional, just burning coal like in the old days in a little stove. And here's the second one I found, which I think you'll find even better. This was microwave biometallic interactions occur in vivo. In vivo means in living things.
Mm-hmm.
Microwave metal interactions in vivo, even at low dose. That's the headline.
Well, and the low dose is what's making people the sickest,
well,
in my experience.
Go.
No, I mean, I'm seeing, you know, everybody I talk to has got ringing in their ears now. Everybody has it now.
Yeah, well, of course, you have to look at B12 as another factor in that because everyone out there is getting full fluorides, whether they like it or not, in the water supply, which is all, everywhere now.
Mm-hmm.
And the fluorides do block folic acid, so they block myelination. And the first nerve to pick it up will be the otic or
acoustic nerve. Yeah, that's interesting.
Nerve.
Yes.
But anyway, when cooking certain vegetables in microwave, sparks occur. A closer exam, the vegetables, as I'm reading, display small burns. Dense vegetables such as beans, carrots, and peppers have a higher amount of minerals than other food items. These minerals include iron, magnesium, selenium. the minerals act like tiny pieces of metal and create arcing effects in a microwave.
Yeah, and in case people are a little confused, just to be really clear, the type of radio frequency that's being used in these communication devices and PDAs and cell phones and wireless routers is microwave. It's just, it's a non-thermal, so you don't get, I mean, people do experience heat when they're using a cell phone or a cordless phone against their head, but mostly even at these really low, when you just got it on around you or you've got a wireless router in the house or somebody, God forbid, next door to you has it and you don't even use it. Now, here's another thing that's interesting. Somebody pointed this out to me. There is this ferromagnetic mineral called magnetite, which animals use in order to detect and use the Earth's magnetic field. And they did some studies in the 1990s and discovered that it's in brain tissue. It's in this cerebral cortex and the cerebellum and then the meninges, which are the membranes surrounding the brain and spinal cord. And
right, isn't that the homing pigeon's tool?
Yeah, well, but we have it too. So I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, here we are with this. You have all this metal toxicity. You've got all these metals, including iron now, and these other metals that you're collecting. And then you've got these very low. One of the other things that Blake Leavitt said, who's a journalist who writes extensively about electromagnetic radiation and radio frequency wireless microwave, is that she suspects that the reason that people who are in urban environments where they're being pounded with exposures don't get as sick as sometimes people who are living in rural environments where there's less of it but it's there is that the low-level exposures, your body actually doesn't know that it's not native, so it starts to readjust stuff. So you don't sleep, and your heart rate goes up. All this stuff happens.
There's so much electromagnetic noise.
Mm-hmm.
Here that we can't even tell that we're surrounded,
right.
Whereas out there you really feel it.
Yes. So the hope.
A new beam and you feel your magnetite pointing south
right.
instead of north.
Right, exactly, very much so. So the hopeful thing here is that with some simple treatments like blood donation, and what we should talk about how that would work. How often would somebody do this and whatnot?
Well, there again, it's something you want to document. You get a baseline reading of your serum iron and your ferrit and your transferrin saturation at minimum, or you can actually get a test where you see how much iron with a fixed a certain dose of the ferritoxin to get the iron out of your system and to see how much comes out, and then you can follow that from time to time. After you've donated some blood, usually you can use about a milligram per pint, and so you may be it may be that there will be dozens of donations before you arrive at a, depending on how much is stored up in you to begin with.
Well, let's not let's give
early,
people
do it once in a while.
Yeah, we're on the radio and lots of people are listening, so a prudent schedule for someone who is testing high in these things that we mentioned.
Well, people who are up at 50% and above, and I've seen them in my practice up to 90% saturated, and they're really symptomatic.
Boy.
We're talking about dementia, depression, and Parkinsonism is obvious. Of course, sex went out the window 20 years earlier. By the time they got to me, nobody made the diagnosis until it was just painfully obvious. And these people are typically in the university setting, where, in other words, you already established protocols in the halls of Ivy where these things are considered maybe not so common. One in 200, you know, of which only maybe one out of by the time you're done with it, one out of every few thousand are diagnosed.
Okay,
so there they do it every week.
Once a week.
And they follow it.
Wow.
They follow it maybe every month or two with to make sure they're not causing an anemia, and then to follow up and see how much of a lowering of the serum iron and the saturation you're accomplishing. That's probably the most prudent and the most
low-cost
way of doing it.
Yeah, but that's a really high saturation. So what about the people who are testing, like this case that we shared with 42%, you know?
At the 40% level, make as few as, even one will sometimes have a surprising benefit.
Yes. Yeah, no, in fact she,
overnight.
Yeah, we did talk to her, and she is feeling better after one.
And
but not completely,
but
it's
both good and bad. The good news is that people say, gee, it works, this is important. And the bad news is they think, gee, what
they stop.
Did that much, I don't have to go back.
Right, they know, or they don't make dietary changes.
They don't understand that the process is a lifetime process.
Yes.
Once you get onto this, this becomes a lifestyle commitment for your health.
Mm.
And you're in charge because nobody's going to be around there to remind you that you've got a wild card in your deck.
All right, so how often should it be repeated in people who are around 40%?
Well, I think if you're symptomatic, you do it the first 2 or 3 months, probably every week. I used to back away from that, but I'm convinced I was wrong. I was reading the whole thing wrong. As I'm re-reviewing this for the umpteenth time, I can see I have not been doing my job diligently enough because I'm doing the math. And to get the iron out of your system, you got to keep doing it. In order, if you want to keep your health, if you want to enjoy your old age,
mm-hmm.
you
so
have
once
clean
a week, once
like
a week,
cleaning.
Once a week for how long?
Well, I would say once a week for the first 3 months.
Three months.
That's right.
Wow. At 40%, that's a lot.
It's about 12. Well, I think you'll see. And if your blood is going down, then you stop. I mean, you have to.
They test you when you go in. I mean, they won't take your blood if you're low.
So that's the first thing. And you don't have to tell the blood bank that you're doing this for yourself. You're doing this to be a generous donor. I mean, you may have to go to different blood banks, I guess, or get an order from a doctor to do it every week. Otherwise, they want to do it every 2 months as a liability issue.
Okay.
But it's more of a liability issue to not do it. That is, if you don't do it for people, they're going to have symptoms or they may even develop some damage. And naturally, if that happens, you'd feel terrible, just as I lost a patient years ago. And I was totally unprepared for it.
All right, but again, we're talking about people who are not. You were talking about him being 50%, being very close to the top of the range. We're talking about people who are.
Well, the range they were giving us at that time was 55%.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been in this nutrition field long enough to know if I don't obey the rules, I'm considered a quack. So in those days, I obeyed the rules because I didn't know then what I know now. And I know I may be a quack, but the world out there at large, the medical world, is just plain wrong about this. And they have to loosen up a little bit and realize that they're doing great harm to the public by missing this diagnosis. Over 90% of the time, 90% of the people that have this problem are not being diagnosed and treated.
Yes, I hear you.
That's why it's really big news and very serious stuff. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you do is the first, I would say, 1 to 3 months, maybe at least the first month. You're going to do it every week if you can or every other week. If it makes you feel bad, if you're woozy, sure, I'm not trying to push us into symptoms. I'm just trying to make sure we don't back off and forget about doing an important medical health service.
Okay.
Then after the first 2 or 3 months, you then maybe take it on once a month for a year.
That sounds right.
And you follow it along. And then you maybe talk to your doctor twice a year to make sure that you're together on it. You're not alone with this thing so that you don't make any stupid mistakes and have problems because, after all, people are different. And it's not all readable in a textbook. You have to know who you're talking about.
Now, we're almost completely out of time, but another thing I found when I was searching around in the literature is that excess dietary iron and iron overload is a root cause for childhood autism and allergies.
Well,
so
it's going a little bit far in as much as the babies are usually born low iron. On the other hand, Mother Nature does want babies to bleed, and the doctors, again, I think, have played it wrong and are shooting kids up with vitamin K at birth.
Yeah.
And so they're not allowed to bleed. So, but, you know, there's no perfect way. There's no perfection.
Well, we're completely out of time. So I've been talking with Dr. Richard Cunyon, MD, and I think you want to give out your phone number, maybe?
Sure. Well, 415-346-2500.
Okay, so 415-346-2500. Dr. Richard Cunyon, you can also go to ohmsociety.com or drinkyourvitamins.com and look for about Dr. Cunyon and his articles. This has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this, as you said, very important and underdiagnosed problem. Thank you. So, I also want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.